Fancy a game?
Tyler Bischoff is...
And are they both trying not to laugh at the word duty?
Yeah.
Technically correct.
Why is she speaking?
Because they learned English from Professor Magoo over there.
Relax, we'll be in and out. Anyway, you've never seen my lab.
Oh, great. I get to see your nerd lab.
Hello, Chandler Stevenson. Who did the Golden Knights trade for? We have an incredible UNLV basketball story coming up later in the show as well, but we are going to start with the Raiders. We had a narrative when John Gruden was hired that the game had passed him by. He hadn't coached in a long time. What was it, 12 years, 10 years since John Gruden last coached when Mark Davis hired him? He kind of fed into that before he ever coached a game by saying things like GPS is analytics. So he definitely didn't make that narrative go away simply by talking. It's pretty clear John Gruden is not actually a moron. He actually can coach football in 2019. But if we look at the recent trend for the Raiders, they have scored 12 points over the last 2 weeks. The last 4 weeks, the offense has been breaking down. The offense was really only responsible for 16 of those points against the Chargers. They only put up 17 on the Cincinnati Bengals, and then 12 over the last 2 weeks. But the more damning thing for John Gruden is this quote from Tyrann Mathieu, Chiefs defensive back. "The biggest thing is we knew that when Carr did take shots down the field, we understood it pre-snap by the formation, and it put us in a position to make a play. Tight ends, running backs, checkdowns, that's his game. We were able to capitalize when he did try to throw it down the field." Now, first off, I love Tyrann Mathieu saying that Derek Carr's game is checkdowns. It's just glorious when opponents say that.
And accurate.
But I'm more curious about what that says of John Gruden. Because what Tyrann Mathieu is telling you is that they knew when the Raiders wanted to throw the ball down the field based on the formation that the Raiders were lined up in. In that game, there were a handful of plays where Derek Carr dropped back to pass. Nobody was, well, can't actually see, but we assume nobody was open because he did not throw the ball. And Derek Carr actually extended plays. He actually moved around in the pocket looking, waiting for somebody to get open, something that he doesn't normally do. And nobody ever came open. He ended up throwing the ball away. That happened about four times against the Chiefs. Ultimately, Derek Carr was 3 of 7 with a pick when throwing beyond 10 yards on Sunday. But based on that quote from Tyrann Mathieu, that's a lot on John Gruden. Like, if you're telling me that, and Tyrann Mathieu might be exaggerating a little bit, like maybe there were two plays in the game where they knew what the play was based on the formation. Maybe it wasn't every single play. But based on that quote from Tyrann Mathieu, if the formation is giving away when they want to take a deep shot, that's on John Gruden. Like, that's Gruden's game plan, and that's some tendency that the Chiefs have figured out over the first, 11 games of the season for the Raiders. To say, hey, when they line up with the tight ends here or with the wide receivers here or whatever it was, they're trying to throw it deep. And so that's on Gruden. And that's the Raiders getting beat extremely bad in pregame prep. And now the Raiders have to go back and they've got to self-scout themselves to figure out what they're doing to give that away. You don't really expect, like, with this team, you don't really expect the deep passing game to be that good. Like, Derek Carr, that's not his strength. They don't have wide receivers. Like, and Gruden's offense, for the most part this year, has been to throw it short. So you'd expect the deep passing game to struggle or not really be a big part of the Raiders' offense. But at the same time, you can't have your formations be what's giving away when you are going to try to throw it deep down the field. And that's, I think, where this comes back to coaching. As much as we want to criticize Derek Carr, as much as we are going to pile on to Derek Carr, justifiably so based on his career in that game against the Chiefs, that's bad as far as the coaching staff goes. Again, it's one player after one game, so it's maybe don't want to read too much into it. It's not really like we haven't heard multiple players or multiple coaches say, yeah, we knew exactly what they were doing. But,
I mean, did anyone even bother to talk to the Jets afterwards?
That's a good point. That's a good point. It was just Sam Darnold making out with chicks.
Oh, yeah.
So,
how did he get mono?
The first time?
No,
He didn't get mono. Can you get mono twice?
I certainly think you can spread it.
So I don't know how much you want to look into that as far as the rest of the season goes for the Raiders and what John Gruden does, but certainly for that game, the Raiders had no deep passing game to speak of, and a player comes out afterwards and said, yeah, we knew exactly when they wanted to throw it deep. Now, we've had this conversation before about the way John Gruden is building his team and how it's not exactly up to par with the NFL current standards, because this is a team that has a very good offensive line that's very good at run blocking. This is a team with a very good running back. Defensively, they don't really stop much very well, but they're much better against the run. They went and got run-stopping defenders. Even though Jonathan Abram hasn't played and Carl Joseph is out, those are run-stopping safeties. Cleveland Furl, all we've heard from John Gruden is how the sacks don't tell the whole story on Cleveland Furl. He's good against the run. Like, they built a defense that they wanted to stop the run before the pass. That's not really what we're doing in the NFL anymore. Like, we're not really, that's not how you win in the NFL anymore. And I'm curious if the blowout loss to the Chiefs is any sort of proof of how unvaluable running backs are in 2019. Josh Jacobs was excellent. 17 carries, 104 yards. The Raiders lost by 31 points. Jacobs had 14 for 95 in the first half. They were down 21-0 at halftime. He only got 3 carries in the second half. Jacobs has been great this year. He was good on Sunday against the Chiefs. He's been two games against the Chiefs. He's been great. 29 carries, 203 yards in two games against the Chiefs. They've been outscored 68-19 in those two games against the Chiefs.
That's, I gotta say, to me, that's not a, if you can't score points because one, you're completely one-dimensional, I don't know how much I can even put that on the coach.
What are you saying?
I'm going back to your previous established point of how much of this is on John Gruden and a lack of scouting. And I flip that pendulum the other direction and go, how much is this that they don't have faith that when they are marching down the field going 78 yards on 27 plays, that when they get there, Derek Carr will make the right decision?
He's done that all year, though. Until the last 4 weeks. He's done that the majority of the year. Like, he's been good the majority of this season. I don't think it's a lack of faith that they have in Derek Carr. Like, and to me, again, in this one-game sample size, if what Tyrann Mathieu is saying is 100% true, it's all on John Gruden. Like, if you're running out there and the defense knows what you're running based on your formation, that's not Derek Carr. It doesn't matter who your quarterback is.
Unless the other formations Derek Carr can't function out of. So you have the one play he can actually do, and everybody knows, oh, this is that one play.
But he's functioned all season, so I don't think that's what it is.
Okay.
Like, I think this scenario is coaching.
Okay, but then how is it that you have one player who is generating this, in Josh Jacobs, who's generating this level of offense, and you're putting up bagels?
Because running backs aren't that important anymore. Like, that's what it comes down to. And Jacobs, while excellent, is not explosive where he's taking off for an 80-yard touchdown run. Like, that just doesn't happen with Josh Jacobs. He'll have some 40- and 50-yard runs, but he's never finishing off runs where he goes the extra 20 and finishes it off for a touchdown. Like, that's not who he is as running back. So, he's excellent, but are running backs even valuable anymore? Like, game flow puts running backs completely out of game sometimes, and that's what you saw with this one. He gets three your best offensive player gets 3 carries in the second half. Why? Because you're down 3 scores, and you can't really run the ball very much.
The only blaring disagreements I have is the Ravens and the 49ers, who have both...
Right, but they don't get down 21-0. Like, when I talk about building the team around running the ball and stopping the run, the Raiders are like 29th, I think, in DVOA against the pass. The Ravens and 49ers are top 5 against the pass. Like, those teams stop the run. And Lamar Jackson's having the greatest season ever. But those teams stopped the run. And I would say the 49ers are probably winning in spite of Jimmy Garoppolo, not because of Jimmy. Like, the 49ers are good at everything
except
Garoppolo.
They're good at running the ball.
Yeah, and defensively, they're good at stopping the pass. The Raiders don't. If the Raiders could stop the pass, they might be 10-2. But they're the third worst team in the NFL against the pass. So if you just give them one, hey, we're good at passing the ball or we're good at stopping the pass,
Fair enough.
Then, okay, that works. They're not. They're not good at either one. So, yes, Derek Carr is an issue, and you can run the ball and have success in the NFL. The Raiders have done that. They've run the ball, and they've had success this year. But when your passing game struggles like it has the last 4 weeks with Derek Carr, and when you still can't stop the pass against anybody except maybe Ryan Finley and the Bengals, that's what the problem is that the Raiders went into this offseason, and they said, what are we going to be good at? We want to be good at running the ball on offense, and we want to be good at stopping the run on defense.
They built their defense to stop their offense.
Yes, and neither one of those are what the NFL is evolving to now. Neither one of those are what's most important in the NFL now. You need to be able to throw the ball, and you need to be able to stop the pass, and that's where their weak spots are on both sides of the ball. Now, it's a rebuilding process. Like, as much as the Raiders have playoff hopes, and we've been talking about the playoffs for a while, it is a rebuilding process, and I think it's fair to give them the benefit of the doubt that's what they strengthen this offseason. Next offseason, they're going to strengthen the pass defense, and they're going to get an actual edge rusher that can get to the quarterback, and they're going to get actual defensive backs that can defend passes. Like, if that happens this offseason, then it's fine. It's a rebuilding process. But what they made a priority this offseason is not what wins in the NFL anymore. And also, to be fair, they did go get Antonio Brown, but he's not there anymore. So I think there's a little bit of concern as far as what exactly John Gruden sees as important and valuable compared to what actually is important and valuable in the NFL. On Josh Jacobs, though, John Gruden said yesterday, Jacobs has been hurt since the game against Green Bay. And then Josh Jacobs posted on Snapchat a very weird photo. You can't really tell what the photo is, but he wrote on there, it's been fractured since week 7. So him saying it has been fractured since week 7, John Gruden saying he injured his shoulder against Green Bay, which is actually week 6.
So he broke it the next week,
I guess, or one of them's confused. I don't know. But basically, Josh Jacobs has been playing through something fractured in his shoulder.
What?
So the question would be, do you need to shut down Josh Jacobs?
Shut it down.
Like, here's my thing. He is still performing at a pretty good rate. Like, the shoulder, there's a little bit of slip in Josh Jacobs, but the shoulder injury hasn't exactly stopped Josh Jacobs. It is football, where guys play through injuries all the time. I would say this. If the Raiders beat the Titans this Sunday, you're playing Josh Jacobs the rest of the year because you have legitimate playoff hopes if you beat the Titans. If you lose to the Titans this Sunday, your playoff hopes are basically gone. So if you lose to the Titans this Sunday, then I would say you definitely need to shut Josh Jacobs down. But there is this weird trend, disturbing trend, of Raiders first-round draft picks playing through injuries in their rookie year. They did it with Colton Miller last year. He got hurt in, what was it, week 4? And like all of his Pro Football Focus grades and everything through the first 4 weeks were pretty good. And then he got hurt, and they made him play through a knee injury, and he was terrible this last 12 games of the year. Like, the worst tackle in football. And people were like, well, he played through a knee injury, so maybe we should give him a break. And now he's been pretty good this year. And now with Josh Jacobs, he's playing through a shoulder injury. So it's just, I don't know, concerning? Is concerning the right word?
I mean, it doesn't seem good.
Like, I know Josh Jacobs and Colton Miller aren't the only players playing through injuries, but it's also like, you're rebuilding? You're not exactly going for the Super Bowl right now, so maybe not play the guys you think the most of through injuries?
How bad was Abram? What was his injury?
His was a shoulder, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what his was.
What's the difference between, I mean, I get one is using their shoulder to tackle, but the other is using their shoulder
to not get tackled.
Yeah. Maybe if you have a shoulder injury, maybe take a couple days off.
Nope, not allowed to. Technically correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. The Orleans has a free rodeo event starting December 5th and running through December 15th. The Orleans Arena will host the All In Barrel Racing, which has free admission. It starts at 9 a.m. every day, so if you're looking for a cheap way to get into the rodeo, head to the Orleans Arena for All In Barrel Racing.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
UNLV commit. Jim and I let the OU has reopened his recruitment. Did I hit any of those words correctly?
I actually don't know how to pronounce his name either. But that is according to Mike Whitman of SB Nation. Ludoulou is a three-star offensive lineman in the 2020 class. He is reopening his recruitment. He said on Twitter he's still committed.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Every commit to UNLV should reopen their recruitment, by the way. They don't have a coach at the school at the moment. So
try to get some extra dosh, man.
I am curious to see how the new coach would be able to keep kids who are getting re-recruited. But it's also a reminder that the early signing period is December 18th, and that is a deadline of sorts for UNLV to bring in a new coach so you don't lose all the kids that are currently committed to UNLV before the new coach even has a chance to re-recruit them, because conceivably, you open your recruitment, some other Mountain West or even Power 5 school comes in and says, hey, they don't have a coach, here's a scholarship if you'd like it, and they sign on December 18th with another school, and now you don't even get a chance to re-recruit them if you don't hire your new coach before December 18th. Current UNLV class has 11 players in it, including Ludoulou, who is still committed but opened his recruitment. They're ranked third in the Mountain West, but most teams don't have 11 commits. They're only eighth in quality of recruit right now, so we'll see how that ends up playing out. I still think the best way to have a competitive year one, whoever the new coach is to keep as much as this recruiting class intact and as much as the current roster intact. That being said, I don't think next year is going to be a very good year regardardless of who they hire, because they're probably going 0-4 in non-conference play.
Why don't they just do what the Tar Heels did and just hire like someone like Mack Brown, and then, you know, first year, you're just good.
Is that how that works?
I believe so, right?
So who should they hire in first year they'd be good?
Is Steve Spurrier alive?
Hugh Freeze. I just want you guys to know, if you don't know who Hugh Freeze is, he was the Ole Miss head coach. They had the number one recruiting class under Hugh Freeze. If they hired Hugh Freeze and had the number one recruiting class in college football at UNLV, UNLV would get the death penalty within 5 minutes.
Oh. Gotta love it.
I think that's a rule. If UNLV ever has the number one recruiting class in football, they cheated. I think that's fair to say.
Good. And I will say that there's a large portion of the fan base that I interact with that would go, that's fine.
I think it's worth it, too.
Yeah.
It probably is.
The city of Las Vegas and the Renaissance Group have extended their talks to bring a new soccer stadium to downtown Las Vegas.
Story in the Review Journal from last week. Yeah. Story in the Review Journal from last week. Back in the summer, city of Las Vegas and the Renaissance Group, that group funded by Seth Klarman, the billionaire, agreed to a 180-day negotiating window. That window is gone. The RJ reported, though, they're giving themselves an extension into February because it's an agreement they just made with each other, so they can do whatever they want. But disappointing to me. Basically, the Renaissance Group wants all the land by Cashman. They want to redevelop that area. Carolyn Goodman said, cool, but you better bring Major League Soccer with you. So the proposed deal would give the Renaissance Group that land or sell it to them, I don't really know, and they would redevelop it, but also they would have to build a soccer stadium, buy Lights FC, and make a push to get Lights FC into Major League Soccer. The reason it's disappointing to me is because I don't understand what's taking so long. They had a six-month window to do this negotiation, and they had been talking for a year and a half prior to that six-month negotiating window. So it's been like 2 years that they've been talking with the city of Las Vegas, and they still haven't figured out how they want to do this. That, A, seems concerning, and B, when you're trying to get a Major League Soccer team, not great.
But there's still, I mean, there's the hidden third factor of MLS. Isn't MLS still just like dragging its feet on who the new team's going to be?
I mean, what's your definition of dragging its feet?
Well, they're up to, what, 29 teams?
Yeah, I mean, they're not in a hurry. They don't have to get to 30 anytime soon.
I know, but if you're like, hey, we're going to build a stadium and we have the, what is it to join MLS? Like, you know,
I think it's $300 million now.
Yeah,
it's going up.
We have the $300 million sitting here. We're all ready. And they're just like, hey, cool your jets, man. It's sort of, well,
I think
then
if
what
they
do
said,
you need to continue to have meetings about?
I think if they went to Las Vegas or went to Major League Soccer and said, here's our stadium plans, here's our funding for it, we have $300 million check for you right now, Major League Soccer would say, all right, you're in. I don't think this is because Major League Soccer is dragging
its feet. So they need to have a meeting with, all right, so the mayor and Seth Klarman need to have a meeting with you so that you can outline the plan of, okay, so all you need is big check.
Yes.
And architect plan.
Yes, and it's done.
And it will be done.
Yes.
All right. Just a problem solving, man. Didn't read the briefs. A formal announcement is expected on Friday that MLS is awarding a new franchise to Charlotte.
That is according to Steve Harrison of WFAE in North Carolina. Harrison said the Charlotte City Council still hasn't approved giving a $100 million-plus incentive to the new Major League Soccer team, but that they're expected to end up giving that sometime soon. This would put an end to Vegas' dream to be team number 30 in Major League Soccer, and Vegas would be hoping to be team number 31 or 32. Major League Soccer has not said for sure they're going beyond 30. They have alluded to it a few times, but 30 has been the only guaranteed number of expansion recently. So maybe it doesn't matter that Renaissance Group and Las Vegas are dragging their feet because 31's not going to be awarded anytime soon. But at the same time, I'm pretty sure if they had a solid plan in place with their expansion fee, Major League Soccer would say, okay, we're going to 32.
The Raiders waived Trevor Davis.
Davis fumbled the kickoff against the Chiefs, and then he got an end-around carry on 4th-and-1 for some reason and did not get the first down, and now he is off the team. I guess he could end up coming back, but he has been waived to make way for Markell Lee, who's coming off IR. But the Raiders, in season, sent a 6th-round pick to the Packers for Trevor Davis. They got 7 catches over 9 games and 19 kickoff returns, and he averaged 0.5 yard less than the NFL average on kickoff return yardage. So, not great. It was just a 6th-rounder, so it's not like it was a very heavy price to pay. But still, he gave up a 6th-rounder, and it wasn't a whole lot of production. I guess they got more out of that 6th-rounder than they got for the Martavis Bryant, A.J. McCarron, and Antonio Brown picks they gave up.
I mean, they got that Colts touchdown, right?
Did he score a touchdown?
Yeah. In week 4 against the Indianapolis Colts, he rushed 2 times for 74 yards, including a 60-yard touchdown.
Oh, that's right. He had a rushing touchdown. I forgot about that.
That's why they gave him the injury.
Yeah, that's right. I should have mentioned
that. It worked one time.
So did he, I think he ended up, did he have more rushing yards than receiving yards?
Oh, golly. All right, let me look. I wasn't prepared for this. No, he had 83 receiving yards and 74 rushing yards.
Close. Almost got there with one run.
Yeah, but I mean,
I think he has more.
I now am fully like one touchdown for a 6th-round pick.
Worth it?
Yeah, worth it.
I guess most of your 6th-round picks get cut anyway, so it doesn't matter.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Whites FC declined their player option on leading goal scorer Irvin Parra.
If you remember this year, Irvin Parra got suspended for complaining about his pay during the season, so not all that surprising that that player would not end up coming back next season. The USL, by the way, for the most part, teams give out 1-year contracts with a second-year option for the team to exercise, is how at least almost every Lights FC contract has been done. So they picked up the option on 7 players, including Thomas Olsen, the goalkeeper, and they declined pretty much any other player, though they did say they were working to restructure deals to bring some of those players back. So they might end up bringing Irvin Parra back, but it's probably not a bad thing if you turn over 90% of the roster of a team that didn't make the playoffs.
Especially considering how much expansion there is in the USL and all those expansion teams inevitably make the playoffs.
Well, so what's weird about expansion in the USL is sometimes the league doesn't actually get bigger because they lose teams kind of frequently too. There's a team in Canada that's not allowed to play in USL anymore.
Because they're not united, or
no? There's a Canada is starting its own professional soccer league.
The pitch is too big,
and they're trying to force Canadian teams to play in that Canadian soccer league. And so, like, the Major League Soccer teams are fine because they're established, but they're like, there's like a handful of teams that had played in the USL in Canada. I think they were the only one last year, but they're like saying, no, we're not granting you permission to play in the USL. You have to play in whatever the hell the Canadian league is called. So random stuff like that happens, and teams fold or go away. And Landon Donovan says, I have a new team. Let's call it the San Diego Loyal. Did the Golden Knights just trade for a player worse than Cody Eakin? Find out next.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Tyler Bischoff is...
Oh my gosh, you guys are... Oh, that's funny.
Oh, this is awkward.
Technically Correct.
The Golden Knights made a strange minor trade. They gave up a fifth-round pick in the 2021 draft, so not even this coming-up draft, the next one. They gave that up for Chandler Stephenson, who is a bottom-six center from the Washington Capitals. I'm not sure how helpful Chandler Stephenson is going to be for the Golden Knights, mainly because I'm not sure Chandler Stephenson is actually better than Nick Waugh. Nick Waugh has... very limited playing time in the NHL this year, only 7 games this season. He played 7 games with Carolina over the previous 2 years. So very, very small sample size, but he does lead the Golden Knights in Corsi at 57%. His expected goals percentage is 52%. Meanwhile, Chandler Stephenson, second worst skater for the Capitals in terms of Corsi and fourth worst in terms of expected goals percentage, 47% in both categories. Those are also career highs for him. His other 2 full seasons in the NHL, he was at 45% or worse in both of those stats. For reference, Cody Eakin this year, 47% in Corsi and expected goals percentage. So analytically, Chandler Stephen is a younger, cheaper version of Cody Eakin. Like, he's 24 years old, he's making $1.05 million, so it's not that much. But his Corsi, the only players with a worse Corsi on the Golden Knights than Chandler Stephenson are Cody Eakin, Derek Engelin, Brandon Peary, and Valentin Zhikov. So I'm not sure how much Chandler Stephenson actually helps this team. Only a fifth rounder. Cost isn't that high. So I don't think there's not much to be upset about. Like, you're not upset because you lost a fifth rounder. It just seems like a little strange. His penalty killing ability might be a big reason why, especially if Cody Eakin's going to be out. He was the 6th most used penalty killer in Washington, so they weren't using him a ton, but he was in rotation for them, and he had pretty much their best penalty kill numbers as far as shots against, chances against, per minute while on the penalty kill. So might be a very valuable penalty killer for the Golden Knights, but that's really the only thing you look at and say, hey, that has a lot of value. You go back to the 5th-round pick. A 5th-round pick has approximately an 11% chance of playing 200 NHL games or more. So Chandler Stephenson is probably better than who you would pick in the 5th round. So I guess it's better to have him than the 5th-round pick. I am curious, though, where does he fit in their pecking order for centers? Like, obviously, William Karlsson's 1, Paul Stastny's 2. Right now, Cody Glass is 3, but until Cody Eakin got hurt, Cody Eakin was 3.
Well, they're having Glass play center, but he's really a winger.
That's right. He's played winger more in his NHL career. You're right. He is a winger. But I don't know. Are they going to use him more than they use Cody Eakin? Based on the way Gerard
Gallant... Right now, they might.
But if Cody Eakin comes back, Gerard Gallant loves Cody Eakin, so I don't know that they're taking him Cody Eakin out of the lineup. Are they going to play him over Cody Glass at center? I guess they could, but I don't know that he's better than Cody Glass. And then you get down to Tomáš Nosek and then Nick Waugh, who they sent to the AHL to make room for Chandler Stephenson. I don't know that he's better than Tomáš Nosek or Nick Waugh. So I'm curious where he fits in. Just, you have centers. You've got, what, seven of them? Is he the sixth best one?
He's a winner, Tyler. He's won a Stanley Cup.
That's right. He did win a Stanley Cup against the Golden Knights.
You need that sort of, like, energy on your team. Just a guy who wins.
I would expect, like, if he ends up being the fourth line center tonight or whenever, I would expect that he actually ends up having good analytics, simply because the Golden Knights fourth line for the entirety of the franchise existence has had great analytics, because the fourth line does not give up chances. They do not give up shots. They don't really create much either, but they usually don't give up very many good shots or chances, and then they get the puck into the offensive zone, and they're not going to do a whole lot with it there, but at least they got it there. And the next line that comes on the ice usually has an advantageous situation. So I would expect that he'll be able to fit right in with Ryan Reeves, Will Carrier, Tomáš Nosek, whoever they end up throwing on the wings. I guess Will Carrier's playing on the third line right now. So Reeves and Nosek. So I would expect him to have decent analytics, so he can help with that. He'll be fine there, and he gives you a little bit more depth on the penalty kill. But I'm not sure exactly how much he actually helps. It seems like a very, very minor move of a guy who you might end up sending to the AHL at some point this season.
I mean, I like the fact that he has, you know, two names I know how to pronounce.
Oh, you do like that, don't you?
Chandler Stephenson.
You think Malcolm Subban's here to steal Marc-Andre Fleury's job?
I don't think it's stealing. I think as of the last three games, I think Subban's sort of playing lights out.
Three straight wins, first three-game win streak for the Golden Knights all season, all with Subban in net. His save percentage over those three is .950. Fun
That's
stats.
Really good.
Fun stats on the season, entire season, 5-on-5. Malcolm Subban's save percentage is .925. Marc-Andre Fleury's is .915. Goals saved above average at 5-on-5. Subban is 2. Fleury is -.17. Again, those are only 5-on-5 stats. Fleury still has the best save percentage in the NHL on the penalty kill at like .946, I think it is. And Subban is like 34th on save percentage on the penalty kill. So that's where Fleury has been unbelievably good, and Subban has been one of the worst in the NHL, is on the penalty kill. So that is a big deal. But 5-on-5, Subban's better, or has been better this year.
I mean, I was also going to point out that at one point, weren't the Golden Knights like highest in penalty minutes?
Yes, he's gotten a lot of chances.
Constantly on the penalty kill.
There have been a lot of chances for them to kill off penalties. But what's interesting to me, and I don't know how much there'd actually be to back this up, but we had the narrative last season. We talked to Ryan about it quite a bit, where Ryan Wallace, Subban didn't get consistent playing time last year, where Subban was pretty much thrown in, you know, every 2 weeks we'll give you a game. And we had this narrative that Subban is better when he gets to just play. Like when he doesn't have to sit out for 3 months before he plays, where he just plays and you just let that guy play and he gets more comfortable. I don't know if there's anything to back that up, but if that's the case, Fleury's been out for a little while, Subban's getting a run here, and he's been very, very good. It seems to be, at least in this sample, that is the case.
Like,
so,
he's actually getting better as game. Like,
yeah.
Each game he plays, it seems like he's playing better, and he's doing... And there were some saves last night that were just pornography.
Well, I mean, he's always made great saves. The problem is he'll usually have a moment in a game where he just loses the puck, and it goes in, and he's like, oh, I didn't see that one.
There was a large Canadian man in my way.
Like, he's always made... It's why he's good on the shootout, is he's got the actual ability to make unbelievable saves. It's just...
He needs to be able to see.
Apparently it's the vision that's always been the problem for him, as he loses the puck more often than not, and that's what I've been told is Fleury's strongest suit, is his vision is excellent. So, can you improve your vision? Can you wear glasses?
Well, we talked to Ryan Wallace about this a little bit, which is the comfort of knowing where your guys are going to be, like, setting up in the crease, compared to just, hey, it's 20 games, get out there. Well, who's this guy? Who's Waugh? I've never played with this guy.
So Chandler Stephenson is going to ruin it for Malcolm Subban tonight.
It might. That could be possible. Just he's standing in front of Subban.
I haven't actually seen. I don't remember what the Golden Knights are doing as far as morning skate today. You think they play Subban back-to-back, or do you think they actually give Garrett Sparks a game?
I mean, it is New Jersey, so I would probably play Subban just for the narrative.
I think you play Subban just because, well, the analytics say your backup goalie is always better than your starter on the second night of a back-to-back. The save percentage difference is like 2%, I think it is, which doesn't sound like a lot, but over the course of a long sample size, it is. So you probably should play Garrett Sparks, but
I don't want to give up 7 goals.
Well, that, but we yell about Marc-Andre Fleury's workload because they expect Marc-Andre Fleury to be the goalie when the playoffs come, and you need him to be conceivably as fresh as possible in the playoffs. You're not really counting on Subban to be your goalie in the playoffs, so it doesn't really matter if you wear him out in December?
I mean, if all else fails, makes Sparks play the Islanders or something. I don't know.
The Islanders are good, though.
Yeah. That way you don't break Subban's confidence.
Oh, okay. So we're going all in on beating New Jersey and all in on, whatever. We'll lose to the Islanders. They beat New Jersey. Yeah, we won 2 of 3 on the road trip. Everything's fine.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right, that might work.
Where do we put the point where people, obviously no one who's a Golden Knights fan, not a hockey fan, is going to go goalie controversy, but this goes another week and Subban keeps winning. At what point do like the Twitter mob start kind of going, maybe we roll with the hot hand?
I think you'd have to see Fleury fail for that to happen. Like, I think that's more like, because that's more likely to cause the fan base in any sport, in any position, especially you talk about football and quarterback. You have to see the starter fail, not just see the backup be good. Like, nobody thinks Fleury is bad, right? So even if you see Subban playing well, you're like, all right, yeah, Fleury's going to play well too. Great, now we have 2 good goalies. Whereas if Fleury was failing, even if we hadn't seen Subban be great, if Fleury was just awful, it'd be like, oh, we got to get somebody else in here. So I don't know how much it is that Subban does as much as, hey, Fleury's back. Oh, my God, he gave up 7 in 4 straight games.
See, I was thinking more of the Alex Smith. He was having a he's really good. He's having his best year. Oh, concussion. Oh, the backup. Oh. Okay, well, you're not needed anymore, buddy.
Possible, but I don't think that actually happens.
No, it's not going to happen.
He won't be out. I assume he won't be out that
long. I'm asking you to create a hypothetical.
28 straight wins. No less than 17 shutouts.
So doable.
Possible.
Okay.
As long as they all go to shootouts. Can't believe he gave a shootout goal, by the way. We didn't talk about that.
I can't believe
last Friday.
He literally stopped it.
He did, and then it still went in.
And it was just like the look on his face of like, really?
Oh, so disappointing. UNLV. Almost got ditched Chris Beard style again.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Tyler Bischoff is
technically correct. The best kind of correct.
We have an incredible hypothetical story. UNLV lost to Cincinnati on Saturday. John Brannan is the head coach at Cincinnati. Before that game, Mike Romalo gave us this story on Twitter. Current Cincinnati coach John Brannan tried to get in the mix for UNLV's coaching opening this offseason, but was ultimately not considered, according to a source. 2 weeks after TJ Otzelberger was hired at UNLV, Mick Cronin left Cincinnati for UCLA. That opened up Cincinnati, which is Brannan's dream job. With his track record at nearby Northern Kentucky, he was a top choice for the Bearcats and had that job sewn up quickly. So UNLV may have avoided another Chris Beard situation if Brannan had been hired by UNLV and then Cincinnati opened up 2 weeks later.
Well, that's why you hire an actual athletic director to make basketball-related hires.
Can you imagine If that happened twice to UNLV in 3 years,
am I the only one that gets the feeling that there's a point where, like, I'm scared this is going to happen again with the football coach? We're going to hire somebody, and then another job's going to open, and all of a sudden it's like, well, no, of course, I'm leaving.
So they shouldn't hire somebody before December 18th. They should wait till all the other jobs are filled and then make their hire.
No, you still have to hire the best guy. Like, Chris Beard would have been a great freaking coach.
It was a great hire. It was a very good hire.
You just don't hire him if you think that his dream job is going to become available.
Well, and here's the problem, though, is if you go back to the Chris Beard situation, what was the domino events? Josh Pastner left Memphis to go to Georgia Tech. Tubby Smith left Texas Tech to go to Memphis. And that left Texas Tech open right after UNLV had hired Chris Beard. Like, it was somewhat of a domino effect that had to happen in that exact order, or it never would have come to Chris Beard leaving after 2 weeks to take the Texas Tech job. He probably would have left after like 1 year, but it probably wouldn't have been 2 weeks. And this one, not quite as significant a domino effect, but 2 weeks later, Mick Cronin's like, yeah, I'll leave Cincinnati now. Like, he's been there for a long time. He's been really good. And he's like, yeah, all right, I'll go to UCLA now. It would have been two instances where in 3 years, UNLV made a hire and through really no fault of their own, lost that hire.
It also, wouldn't it be the second time somehow Mick Cronin screwed UNLV?
Kind of, yeah, a little bit. What would have been interesting is, let's say in the hypothetical they hired John Brannon, what that buyout would have looked like. Because T.J. Altzelberger's is pretty steep, but it's not crazy steep for him to leave UNLV for a better job. If you remember, the Chris Beard one was he had to pay $1 million. So UNLV got $1 million for having Chris Beard for 2 weeks. But it's significantly more now.
Okay, I'm on the other side now. We need to do this with every coach.
Three times every offseason, yes.
You want swimming and diving? We need to be embarrassed on a national stage.
So I'm curious like what that buyout would have been, because it's conceivable it could have been significant enough to where he would have been like, all right, like Cincinnati would have been like, all right, we're not paying you $7 million to get John Brannon away from you. And John Brannon would have been like, well, I don't have $7 million to go there either. I've been coaching at Northern Kentucky. So kind of wish that would have happened. That would have been terrific. They probably could have had that happen and still gotten T.J. Altzelberger.
I mean, maybe.
But then we might not have Jonah Antonio. Might have missed out on him.
Exactly. And also, we would miss out. Would we have needed the level of subterfuge that DRF went through in order to get T.J. Altzelberger if it was like, yeah, you're coming into a weird situation, man?
I don't know what your sentence was supposed to mean. Last thing on UNLV basketball. Donnie Tillman, supposed to be UNLV's second-best player. He's had some great games this year. UCLA at 18, Cali at 17. But Donnie Tillman had 2 points against Cincinnati. He also had 1 point against Kansas State. He did not start against Cincinnati. T.J. Altzelberger said yesterday it was some sort of punishment. He was late to something, and that was his punishment. So he did not start. He only ended up playing 22 minutes. He got benched in that game against Kansas State, only played 16 minutes in that one. The interesting part to me is he's fourth on this team in minutes. Amari Hardy and Elijah Mitrulong are basically players that T.J. Altzelberger views as they cannot come off the floor. They have played 89 and 87% of the team's minutes this year. And Mbaki Zhang's played 78%. Tillman has played 70% of the minutes. So Altzelberger, he views Hardy and Elijah Mitrulong, those guys can't leave the floor. He does not view Donnie Tillman that way. And that, I think, is a problem for UNLV. Because A, it means you got to play Nick Blair, Vitaly Sheba more often. But B, Tillman is supposed to be the second best player on this team, if not the best player on this team. He comes in from Utah, gets automatic eligibility, sixth man of the year at Utah last year. And he has not been their second best player. There's been moments where you're like, oh yeah, that guy's good. But in two of their biggest games, Cincinnati and Kansas State, he's been a no-show. And I'm curious if Altzelberger needs to just let Tillman go, just play him through games that he struggles, or if it is best case scenario to pull him out because you get more from Nick Blair. They really, really need him to be the second best player on the team. Like, if they're going to do anything, Tillman's got to be good.
Take that, you analytic guys.